And welcome back to this week's episode of Tech Plus. Today you are joined by myself, Kane, and unfortunately Ion will not be able to join us today. It'll just be myself, so strap in and enjoy the ride. Let's get into it. It's been a crazy week of tech. It's been absolutely busy and busting with Elon Musk news and TikTok news and a space flight that went successful, which was 2 years or almost 3 years in the making. So we're going to go over all of this today. I hope you guys enjoy. First things first, we're taking a look at Twitter, which is in the spotlight at the moment, having to pay a $150 million fine for using people's security phone numbers to target ads. And the reason that this is a problem is because it has been deceptively done, right? Twitter has deceptively used members' email addresses and phone numbers for targeted advertising. And on top of the fine, Twitter has to also accept audits of its data privacy program, among some other restrictions as well. The illegal filing claims that Twitter misrepresented its policies to users between 2013 and 2019, violating both the FTC Act and an order from a previous settlement in 2011. The company encouraged users to add a phone number or email address to enable security measures like two-factor authentication. In reality, however, Twitter has also incorporated that information into its ad targeting data. It apologized for the practice in 2019, saying it had inadvertently funneled the addresses and numbers into its ad system. The complaint also alleges that during that period, Twitter was falsely claiming to comply with the European Union and a Swiss-US Privacy Shield frameworks, which restricted how companies could repurpose user data. The $150 million fine penalty reflects the seriousness of the allegations against Twitter and the substantial new compliance measures to be imposed as a result of today's settlement, and will help prevent further misleading tactics that threaten users' privacy. And it's pretty bad. So you would have signed up on Twitter, given in your phone number, thinking, I'm enabling an additional layer of security. And Twitter did allow that additional layer of security to be created. However, it then also sent your number into its mobile ad targeting network, so that if someone had found you or had your phone number on their file, they could reach you through advertising through Twitter. So not exactly what they said they were going to use it for, but I always actually suspected that might be a problem with certain apps and things like that, when you're signing up and giving your phone number. And I think to myself, you know, surely they're going to use my phone number for advertising and things like that. And obviously, as you know, as true as it sounds, it probably is. So there you have it, you know, and only $150 million fine. In the greater scheme of things, it's not very much, right? Because you got Elon Musk going to buy Twitter for, you know, $36 billion. What is $150 million on that amount? It's not much. Speaking of Elon Musk will now put up a $6 billion to drop Tesla loans from his Twitter deal. So that's pretty insane. The Tesla CEO will no longer finance his Twitter buyout by borrowing against his Tesla shares, which was originally what the plan of action was. And after a brutal month for Tesla stock, Elon Musk will no longer fund his Twitter buyout by borrowing against his Tesla ownership stake. In a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission, Musk announced that the expiration of a series of margin loans against Tesla stock, which had been included as part of his original financing plan to acquire Twitter, as part of the announcement, Musk committed to providing an additional $6.25 billion in equity finance, bringing his total commitment to $33.5 billion. And the main reason for that is because of all the scrutiny he received for actually utilizing his Tesla stocks to help fund his Twitter buyout, right? It kind of shows that he's not as interested in Tesla as he should be, and would rather lose some of his hedge in Tesla in order to acquire Twitter. And, you know, investors aren't too happy about that plan of action. Musk's initial plan to acquire Twitter involved a combination of $21 billion in personal equity and $25.5 billion in loans. $12.5 billion of those loans were secured against Tesla shares owned by Musk. Musk cut that number in half with an earlier round of equity financing and has now restructured the deal to remove them entirely. The move comes in response to growing pressure on the loans and Tesla stock generally. The carmaker's share price has cratered since Musk announced his buyout plans, shedding more than 30% of its value over the course of a month. So Tesla shares down 30%. Musk thinking that's not going to be good. You know, you can't really use a loan against Tesla shares that are dumping. It's not really the most strategically clever idea. So here we have a restructured deal that isn't inclusive of any of Tesla stocks, and we just have to wait and see how that plays out and if he really will purchase Twitter, and will the deal finally go through. Because at the same time, Musk has come out and said unless Twitter can prove that the bot issue isn't as significant as he thinks, the deal would be put on hold. So they have to kind of sort that out as well. They got the bot problem, and now we've got the deal restructuring. It's a wild, wild west out there. TikTok's now launching a Twitch-like subscription as well, and it's in beta today, which is very interesting. Normally, we see a lot of companies copying TikTok, right, with the likes of Meta and things like that. It's traditional. You know, TikTok comes out with something, then Instagram comes out with Reels, for example, right? So that's a problem. For TikTok, but now TikTok's having a chance to play around a little bit with some of the copying, right? And in this case, it's to do with Twitch. So TikTok has announced a program that lets viewers pay to subscribe to specific live streamers they want to support, dubbed Live Subscription. It gives fans access to perks like a subscriber-only chat, creator-specific emotes, and badges that differentiate them from non-subscribers. It's launching in beta on the 26th of May, according to an announcement video posted on TikTok's live creator page. That page has also posted videos from several creators announcing that they're part of this program and announcing the potential benefit to their followers. For an example, for an amount of about, you know, $4.99, you can subscribe to a TikTok content creator on a month-to-month basis. The benefit for creators is a more sustainable and more estimatable income on a month-to-month basis, which was traditionally a problem for TikTok until they announced their ad revenue sharing, which was part one, I assume, of many parts to help creators earn more money. And this next part is taking a page out of Twitch's book and creating the subscription model, whereby you can subscribe to creators. Would I subscribe to a creator? Not at this current time. I don't actually even subscribe to people on Twitch, just because, you know, a lot of people don't have that kind of money. $4.99 a month is, you know, half of your Disney Plus subscription. You know, and some people just can't afford that. But people that can afford it will have, you know, unique benefits when they're chatting on the creator's page that they're subscribed to. They'll have some sort of differentiating factor so that if you're subscribed to the creator, you make a comment, your comment stands out more than people who aren't subscribed to the creator. And that's generally how these kind of subscriptions models work. It gives you a cleaner and a little bit more of a sophisticated connection to the content creator. And that's something that TikTok's coming out with today, in fact, so maybe worth checking it out. Now we're going to head over to a music break, and when we come back from the break, we'll be taking a look at Boeing's Starliner spacecraft, which managed to return to Earth, Apple's secretive car project that lost another top executive, and Meta, who just opened their first physical retail store. Stick around, we'll see you in a minute. And welcome back. So right now we're taking a look at Boeing's Starliner spacecraft has returned to Earth, wrapping up a critical mission test. And this is something that has been ongoing for a while, and it's actually quite an accomplishment because of what it opens up for the possibility in the future. So it's been a long road, but Starliner has finally flown to and from the space station. After spending a little less than a week at the space station, Boeing's new passenger spacecraft, the OST-100 Starliner, has returned to Earth this afternoon, landing intact with the help of parachutes and airbags in the New Mexico desert. The successful touchdown brings an end to a critical test flight for Starliner, one that showcased the vehicle's ability to launch to space, dock with the station, and then return home safely. Shaped a bit like a gumdrop, Boeing's Starliner capsule was built in partnership with NASA in order to launch the agency's astronauts to and from the space station, or the ISS, and the mission is part of NASA's commercial crew program. which challenged private companies with creating space taxis to carry people to low Earth orbit. But before NASA will let its personnel ride on the vehicles, the space agency wanted Starliner to demonstrate that it could in fact go through all the motions of a trip to the ISS without people on board. With today's landing, that uncrewed test flight called OTF-2 has come to an end, with Starliner performing every major step it was meant to accomplish, and the capsule successfully launched to orbit on the 19th of May, riding to space on top of an Atlas V rocket. It approached and docked with the ISS on the 20th of May, and it undocked with the space station this afternoon before heading home. It wasn't a completely smooth flight though. Throughout the mission, Starliner encountered a number of issues with various thrusters, which are tiny engines used to maneuver and propel the vehicle through space. None of these problems proved to be a fatal one though for the flight, and Starliner was able to complete OTF-2 as planned. It's also been a bumpy road getting to this launch. The name of the test flight, OTF-2, actually stands for Orbital Flight Test 2. That's because it's actually a do-over of the same test flight that Boeing tried to perform back in 2019. In December of that year, Boeing launched Starliner without a crew on board, sending it to space on another Atlas V rocket, but a software glitch on Starliner caused the capsule to fire its thrusters incorrectly after it separated from the rocket, and ultimately the spacecraft got into the wrong orbit, and the issue prevented Starliner from reaching the space station, and Boeing was not able to show that spacecraft's ability to dock with the ISS. Boeing had to bring the spacecraft home early and was able to land the capsule in the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico, the same location Starliner landed today. So it's actually quite an achievement, something that's been a few years in the making, and it is in essence what is going to be the method to get astronauts from Earth to the International Space Station and then taxi back to Earth again when they are ready to do so. And this flight will be performed over and over and over again, so it's so important that Starliner can prove with no element of doubt that it is capable of performing this exact test many times over, because lives are on the line at that point when an astronaut sits inside that vehicle. And that's where we're up to in terms of Boeing Starliner spacecraft. You know, it's back in Earth. You can read about it online. I definitely suggest doing that. It's a very interesting read. On to the next bit of news, though. Apple's secretive car project has lost another top executive. And this is sad because Apple has been trying to build a car for quite some time. Former Tesla autopilot chief CJ Moore is leaving Apple to join Luminar. So Christopher O.J. Moore, the former Tesla autopilot software engineer who left to join Apple's secretive car project last year, has left Apple to join Luminar, an Orlando, Florida-based LiDAR company, and its new head of software. The company announced Moore only lasted 7 months at Apple. Moore is among a group of top executives from other leading companies to join Luminar, which makes the laser sensor that helped autonomous vehicles see their surrounding environments. But his departure from Apple is yet another indication of the tech giant's struggle to retain talent for its befuddled efforts to make an autonomous electric car known as Project Titan. We're attracting the best leaders in the world in their fields to execute our vision and deliver on the future of transportation, said Luminar CEO Austin Russell in a statement, and spokesperson for Apple did not immediately respond to The Verge's request for a comment. The departure in the latest shakeup for Apple's car division, which has undergone numerous changes over the past several years. Last year, the project's chief Doug Field left Apple to join Ford, where he was later put in charge of digital systems at the automaker's newly created Model E division for electric and autonomous vehicles. Kevin Lynch, who ran Apple's watch division after serving as CTO of Adobe, was tapped to replace Field. A few weeks later, in November 2021, Moore joined Apple to work on self-driving software, reporting to Stuart Bowers, another Tesla expat who previously served as the vice president of engineering. And this is very interesting. You know, the working hands that are responsible for making autonomous vehicle driving possible are like moving between all these different software companies as they are you know, in demand, and all everyone's trying to, you know, trying to come up with the newest technology and trying to get the biggest amount of, you know, room in the door and have the largest share of the market. And it's just an absolute, you know, an absolute rush for these employees and these staff to work for certain companies to try and get them. So it's in demand. And if you're a youngster who's thinking about, you know, a field to get into, autonomous vehicle, self-driving vehicles, you know, that's a good place to go. You're definitely going to find a job if you go down that direction, that's for sure. Right, next up, we're going for a music break, and then we're going to listen to our last two updates, which is Meta's first physical store is opened up, and also Asus has announced the world's first 500Hz NVIDIA G-Sync monitor. And it's quite an achievement, because we're talking about being able to display information on a computer screen at 500 frames per second. How impressive is that? Okay, welcome back to Tech Plus. We're taking a look now at our last few stories of the day. We're almost done at this point. We're taking a look at Meta, which opened its first physical store. This is a physical retail store in Burlingame, California. Right. And CNBC reports that Meta is taking the next step in its evolution away from being an ad-supported social network to a hardware-driven tech company for the metaverse age, with the opening of its first ever retail store. The move comes as the tech giant bets on the metaverse age and looking to expose consumers to Meta products, which you really have to experience to understand, insists the head of the first store. According to Meta, consumers will be able to get a hands-on experience with all of its hardware products. Martin Gillard, head of Meta Store, says that the store is designed to expose to consumers to Meta's products, which you really have to experience to understand. And I can't agree more. A friend of mine the other day came around and showed me his Oculus Quest 2, which is the VR headset. And I would have never expected the extent to which you could be impressed by this technology until I put those VR headsets on and I actually played around with it. And it's absolutely mind-blowing. That's what it is, truly and honestly. You know, the VR headsets have evolved so much that when I last checked and read about VR headsets, I was looking at like the HTC Vive, where in order for you to be able to operate in this 3D space, you have to set up some cameras in your room. Four cameras, to be in fact, front left, front right, back left, back right, and it monitors you and it knows what your movements are. But when it comes to the Oculus Quest 2, the software aspect has been so significantly improved that when you put the headset on, instead of having to rely on four third-party cameras, you know, fixed around your room, Meta has included the ability for the VR headset to have a functional camera in it as well. So when you put the headset on, you can see what's around you, and you're actually looking through a camera lens, obviously, and you can see what's around you and it's being displayed in the VR headset. But then what you do is you actually map out your playable space. So in the same way that previous models would have used the cameras, you know, the four fixed cameras around you to see where you are and see what the space is, you actually map out that space in the room. You select your playable region, it becomes a 3D space that you can move around in, and this is all done on a software level. So as I said, you know, you have to be able to see it to experience it. You have to be able to see how significantly advanced the technology is and how much room for future development there is to really go home with a oh my word moment. And now I sit here every single day, you know, really considering buying a VR headset. Even though they are very expensive, they range between 8,000 and 15,000 rand a headset, it is so tempting to get that VR headset because of how monumentally world-changing it is. And these headsets actually aren't required to actually have to be plugged into a computer in order to be able to play them. They're self-standing. There's software on the headset that you can experience. So in South Africa, when we have load shedding for your 2.5 hours, you go, you pop in your VR headset, and you transcend into virtual reality and play games and things like that. I mean, that's really, really cool. So it's really interesting to see that they also saw the same problem in its difficulty to describe and to really have people see the potential. So creating a physical retail store is obviously the next best option. And finally for today, our last piece of news is Asus announces the world's first 500Hz NVIDIA G-Sync gaming display. And because, why is this so important? Yes, it's gaming. Yes, it's a big number. But what does 500Hz mean? Well, 500Hz is like the frame rate of your monitor or your display. So a traditional TV would have like a 60Hz display. It would be able to display information at 60 frames per second, and that is your, what you would call the quality. If that was 120 frames per second, the immediate differences that would you would notice is a much smoother experience. And it has been hypothesized that people are only able to really see at about 120 frames per second, as in our natural, you know, ability to digest visual information using our eyes is about 120 frames per second. It might go to 240 frames. You can't really be sure. It is just an hypothesis, right? How do you measure that? And with each person's perspective being a little bit different, it's hard to kind of pinpoint the exact refresh rate that humans would have in their natural vision. However, Asus has now announced their 500Hz or 500 frames per second monitor, and our previous best, you know, industry performing option was 240Hz or 240 frames per second maximum, and they've basically doubled that. And what they say the reason for that, and it's specifically targeted at like esports gamers, and when they're able to see at, you know, twice the maximum, previous maximum refresh rate, when they can see it, that they are able to see an image that is much smoother. If you're an esports gamer and you're aiming down the sights of your gun to shoot at someone else, because the frames are a lot more, there's a lot more frames in every single second, a person's movement from the start of the 500 frames and the end of the 500 frames is much more of a smoother transition, opposed to having that be the same amount of movement over the same duration, but 60 frames of information fit into that. So it allows gamers to essentially see finer movements of players. And in gaming, you have this thing called ghosting. So if the refresh rate is very slow, the model or the 3D model that you would see moving across the screen would almost ghost. It would, like, there would be more than one of them on the screen at any given time. And it's kind of akin to if you take your mouse on your computer, if you're ever looking at your computer screen and you just move your mouse very quickly, you'll notice that there's many mouses on the screen. You know, your one mouse turns into like five or six if you move it very cross, very fast left to right. The mouses turn into five or six, and if you had a much more responsive Hertz monitor, that mouse would just be one mouse that would move more solidly, as if you were to move left and right much slower. There's just one mouse is there, opposed to moving it fast where there are many. The same problem happens with 3D models. And that is the end of the Tech Plus show for today. I hope you guys have a fantastic rest of your week. Thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in. I'll see you next week for another episode of Tech Plus. Have a great rest of your week, everyone. Chat to you later. Bye-bye.